Hi, everyone. You know, Mahatma Gandhi said, be the change you want to see in the world. So I'm going to introduce my own self here. But the practical reason is I have a lot of slides, and I want to make sure that there is enough time for questions. So hi, everyone. My name is Shri Zawadekar. I am a principal engineer at Intuit. And today I'm going to talk a little bit about how we went about running Kafka on Kubernetes. How did we go about from evaluation to production at Intuit? So here is a brief agenda of what the talk is going to be structured around. I'll talk a little bit about why we decided to use Kafka. Why did we think about Kubernetes for Kafka, the Kafka on Kubernetes architecture, and then talk about some of the problems and solutions that we ran into. The problems will be probably common to all of us if and when we decide to run this. Solutions may change depending on, you know, your environments, your SLAs, your cloud environments, and everything else. So why Kafka? So within Intuit, I work for a group called the Small Business Group. It runs this popular application called QuickBooks Online. QuickBooks Online is a SaaS service for small businesses to do accounting, payroll, and financial management. And this has been an application that's been used for quite a while by small businesses. There are millions of customers. And it's a monolithic application. It's been around for a while. It's a Java application. And it's a big monolithic application, which itself caused quite a lot of trouble. It's complex in nature. It has tightly coupled modules. It was hard to kind of, you know, roll out features at a good cadence, at a good pace. And therefore, the idea was, given this new world of cloud and DevOps and everything, and containers especially, we want to break it up into microservices. When we do this microservices, decompose this into microservices, each of these microservices could have its own release schedule, release cadence, and so on and so forth. Kind of pretty much the way you would want monolithic applications to be kind of broken up. And then when these microservices are actually up and running, they would still need to be able to share data between each other. Someone would want to send data, the other one processes it, sends it to someone else, so on and so forth. And this is where Apache Kafka came into picture. The architecture was that we break up the monolithic application into microservices and then kind of have this central nervous system based on Kafka through which these microservices are able to communicate with each other. Why Kubernetes for Kafka? So me and some of my team members actually had a lot more experience of running Kubernetes, in some sense, even before the hype that we see around Kubernetes nowadays. And we genuinely believe that Kubernetes is a very good platform for running containerized applications. It's actually becoming the de facto standard for running containerized applications today. It's very cloud aware. It's very AWS aware. So the entire talk that I'm going to talk about today is about running Kubernetes clusters on AWS. So Kubernetes is very cloud aware. It understands it's running on AWS and is therefore able to incorporate some of the features that AWS can provide. And then it has some really good options for running stateful applications. It's actually coming to that. It wasn't this way a few years ago, but Kubernetes nowadays has a lot more options for running, especially for running Kafka. So stateful sets is a great example of this. Stateful sets is a concept in Kubernetes where a pod and an EBS and a volume essentially is considered as one pair. And when you say that, hey, Kubernetes, give me like five replicas of this, it'll give you five such pairs where the pod and the volume are together. When you want to scale it down, it'll scale it down accordingly, where you say, I want to go from 5 to 3, and then it'll scale down these pairs, and therefore you are kind of in good shape. Config maps, like most other applications, Kafka especially comes up with a big detailed configuration file. And you want all these multiple pods that are going to run Kafka brokers to be able to access the same config information. So config maps are great. You create your config file, create it in Kubernetes as a config map, and then tell Kubernetes that, hey, this is a config map that I want to map, that I want to mount in all my replicas, and Kubernetes will do it for you. Secrets, we use SSL. So for SSL certificates, we want a place to store them and make this available to all the replicas in the stateful set. So Kubernetes secrets were great for that. And then pod and node anti-affinity and affinity. So containers have multiple applications. Some of them are geared towards how you can make maximum use or maximum utilization of a given node, but it has problems with how you would want to. It has problems of availability. If you're running multiple containers in one VM or one EC2 instance or one machine, if that machine goes down, all those nodes go down. specifically for Kafka, we did not want this. We wanted each of these Kafka brokers to be spread out as much as possible. So pod anti-affinity in Kubernetes actually helped us with this, where we said that, hey, here is a pod, or here are five replicas that I want to run, and I want them to run in such a way that each pod cannot co-locate with any other pod in the same replica. In the same stateful set. So that way, each pod kind of went to different nodes, which kind of gave us the availability guarantees that we were looking for. And then lastly, extensibility offered by containerized environments. So, you know, running an application by itself is great. But as I will show you, there are many a times there are these last mile problems that, you know, fine, this application is running great, but for a user to be able to access it, I need to have a good web-based interface, or I need a way in which I want to maybe do some minor translation of my metrics so that it's compatible with my metrics endpoint. These kinds of tiny tools and utilities which kind of land up becoming the last mile problem, it's good to have to run in containerized environments, because these tiny tools are made available as containers, and then it's all about running another container or another sidecar. And I'll show you a couple of examples of this. So it was great. We thought that, you know, Kubernetes conceptually has a lot of good constructs for running Kafka. We should try this out, but where do we begin? And like all talented engineers, the first thing we did was to find if someone else has done it. So we actually Googled for this, and we actually found this really good repo by a company, I believe it's called Yolin.com. If someone here, by the way, is from Yolin.com, please get in touch with me. I owe you a drink or a coffee or a meal or, I don't know, Halloween cookies. But yeah, we found this repo, and it was very much in line with what we wanted. If we were able to set up a multi-zone Kubernetes cluster, that particular repo was giving us Kafka itself, the Kafka brokers as one stateful set, Zookeeper as one stateful set, the configuration as available as config maps. And one additional thing which was kind of, you know, icing on the cake was that it had, instead of just running the jar that Kafka brokers are, it actually had a nice shell script which made it a little customizable if you wanted to. And along the way, this was open source. We found some issues with it. We've been good citizens. We contributed back. We contributed issues. We contributed code. We contributed some suggestions. We've answered some questions other people had. So it's a great repo to get started off. So we just said, okay, let's take this. We ran it on a cluster, and we were like, we did our fundamental testing, the first thing that you would do. Like, you know, if something says it's running, we were like, oh, let me create a topic. And we were able to do that. Let me send a message on this topic. And yes, I'm able to do it. Let me read a message. It was working fine. Okay, let me write a shell script which, like, you know, consistently produces and on the other side consistently consumes. And it was working fine. So it was like, okay, this shows great promise, but what if there is a little more load on the system? Is it going to sustain? Is something going to break? So we kind of thought of this as kind of getting some sort of a baseline of what we expect or what we could then build off. So we decided to do a basic performance experiment. This was nothing. There was no code that we had written. We had just taken what they had, maybe just tweaked the replica number from 3 to 5 or something like that, and then just started off. So with this, we did a basic performance experiment with 5 Kafka brokers spread across 3 AZs. The broker config itself, so the JVM had 8 vCPUs and 6 gigs of memory, replication factor of 3. We wanted all 3 replicas to be in 3 different on 3 different EBS volumes, so that way we have greater availability, 10 producers and a message size of 10 KB. And with this, we measured the end-to-end latency. The E2E latency here is basically the latency from the time a producer produces a message, goes onto the Kafka bus, and there is a consumer who's consuming this message on the same topic, and he's consuming the message from on the other side. What's the time required for the producer to finish and for the consumer to finish consuming? This end-to-end latency. And this is the number we got. This is kind of the performance that we got. We wrote about 50,000 messages. And it's a little up and down. I would have rather liked it to be kind of a straight line, just makes the engineer in me kind of a little more at peace. But there was some churn happening up and down there. The other part that was interesting was that the first message always took a little more time. This was because the SSL handshake can take a long time. There was also a problem that we discovered in AWS that if you have IP fragmentation packets being sent and there is an AWS NAT gateway in between, that NAT gateway just drops this on the floor. So you have one side sending a message, the other side saying, hey, your packet is too big, break it down. But in between, the NAT gateway just drops this, so the other side doesn't know. It keeps sending the same packet. And then somehow, magically, if the other side decides to randomly pick a different number where the packet size is small, then the SSL handshake went through and things were fine. So the first initial connection started would take a long time. We were able to fix this by actually explicitly setting the TCP MTO on all the components involved in between. Later, but this was just the beginning. So we were here. We were getting an average E2E latency of about 35 milliseconds, which was good, you know, but we were like, this is fine. I mean, we want to earn our living. So we don't want to just take a public repo, run it, and say, okay, we are done. So we said, okay, let's see if we can do better. At the same time, we wanted to go to our other engineering teams and figure out what the requirements really were going to be. This Kafka cluster that we are going to build and support and deploy, what is it going to be used for if you take inputs from all the possible teams? So these were the inputs we got. We were going to get 9,000 messages per second. Each message was going to be about 50 kilobytes in size, and given the compression that Kafka offers, there'll be 10x compression, so the expectation was each message on disk will be about 5 kilobytes in disk and on over the network. 7-day retention period for each of these messages, 3 replicas, and about 200 topics on the cluster. The other thing that we asked them was about the E2E latency. We asked them about what would they want, and the general answer that we got was, oh, if it's less than 100 milliseconds, we are good. So we were like, okay, fine, we are already at 35, which is great, but we need to factor these in and kind of come up with an architecture that can support this. So after giving it some additional thought, this is what we said we'll do. This was theory, this was slideware, and we'll see how we went about actually deploying this. So we are going to have a Kubernetes cluster where we'll have 3 master nodes, each in one in each zone. So 2A, 2B, 2C are kind of the 3 zones in the Amazon US West region. So 3 masters, one in each zone. Zookeeper is required to be odd in number because it runs a leader election. So there were 5 instances of Zookeeper. And then Kafka, based on the requirements that I mentioned in the previous slide, we said we'll have about 9 brokers. And it was 9 was a good number because we could say 3 in each availability zone. So that was good. Now, one of the ways in which Kafka works is that as a client, it needs to be able to individually communicate with any broker. The actual communication happens with each broker depending on the topic and depending on the partition that it gets assigned and so on and so forth. So what can we do so that each broker gets an individual publicly accessible IP? Not necessarily publicly, but each broker can be individually addressable from outside of this AWS account. So we decided to use a network load balancer there. The network load balancer would kind of be the fronting thing for all Kafka brokers. So each of those 9 brokers will have private IPs. They'll export a particular port, 1 port per broker. And then NLB is basically the thing, the DNS name of the NLB is what gets shared with other, with the consumers or with the clients of this Kafka setup so that they connect with any of the brokers using the NLB DNS name colon P0 for, say, Kafka 0, P1 for Kafka 1, P2 for Kafka 2, where P0, P1, P2 are port numbers. So this is what we had. Kafka and Zookeeper run in their own individual autoscaling groups, 1 Kafka broker per instance. So as I said, we didn't want multiple Kafka brokers on the same instance because we didn't want to have 2 of them go down if that EC2 instance goes down. And then 1 Zookeeper per EC2 instance because we didn't want Zookeeper or Kafka to co-locate so that if they go down, there'll be some outage. So this is what I said we'll have, and this is what I want to show that we have right now. So this is a cluster that I have running right now. As you can see here, these are the pods. So I have a stateful set which has 9 replicas. And Kubernetes does a good job of naming them. So the stateful set is called Kafka. It names the pods as Kafka 0 to Kafka 8. The 5 Zookeeper instances are called P0 to P0.4. Config maps here. So there is a broker config. This is the config map used by all the 9 brokers. Zookeeper config is the config map used by the Zookeeper instances. If I do... So if you look at the stateful sets, here are the stateful sets. Kafka is a stateful set. There are 9 instances. Pzoo, which is the Zookeeper stateful set, which has 5 instances. So this is what we have. That's good. We got this running. And now we go into the individual cases of what each one feature at a time, especially when we had to decide to go to production. You know, getting this up and running was fine. What about NLB configuration? So I already briefly touched upon this where I said there's one NLB, and that one NLB is able to talk to all the 9 brokers behind it. So you can see here port 32400 is forwarded to broker 0, port 32401 is forwarded to broker 1, so on and so forth. Kafka itself requires a client endpoint as well, a client port, which is where anyone can connect and discover what is the current set of brokers. So that is called a client port. So that was this client port called 9094. It does nothing other than just redirecting the request to any of these other remaining 9 actual brokers. So you connect to port 9094, it just goes to anyone else and says, hey, give me a list of all the current brokers and their IP addresses. It returns the name of the NLB and the port number, saying these are your 9 brokers. So this is good for NLBs. One other reason, by the way, to use NLBs was so that we could use Amazon's private link. So if there are other things running in other AWS accounts, instead of having to deal with security groups and things like that, creating a private link with NLBs is a good option. I'll talk more about private links later offline if anyone has more questions. So this was great. Network configuration was good. The setup was solid, but of course, security. So 2 parts to security. One is, or 3 parts rather, authentication, and then what about data at rest? What about data in transit? So for authentication, we decided to use mutual TLS. The broker, which is a server process, will itself have an SSL cert, and it will also have the certs of any of the clients that it can connect to it. So a client has to present its cert. A broker will say that, okay, I know this certificate, so I know you as a client, so I'll accept your connection, otherwise it will not. And same way, the broker has to present its certificate to a client, and the client will then say, okay, I'm connecting to this broker. So with mutual TLS, the benefit that we got was both sides were talking SSL, so the communication was over was secure. That gives us one benefit. And the second thing was we also got authentication. Only a client with a cert would be able to talk to the Kafka cluster. And then for data at rest, AWS has AWS supports EBS volumes, which can be encrypted. And then Kubernetes does a good job here, where you can say that, hey, Kubernetes, give me an EBS volume with data at rest encryption, and Kubernetes does it for you. It creates a key in Amazon's KMS, key management service, and then uses that key for encrypting the data that is going to the EBS volume. So this was good. Okay, so the data is secure. Cluster is running, but to be able to support this in production, I need 2 things really, really badly. I need access to logs, and I need access to metrics. What do we do for it? So for logging, Intuit already had a setup of Splunk, and essentially the problem now became that, hey, I have a Splunk endpoint. This is where all of our logs are going in anyway. Okay, what can you do so that now you can get Kafka logs into Splunk? If you can do that, then we are in sync with the rest of the applications that are running in the company. So we looked around. Fluentd is a good way of running something on the cluster that can collect logs of all the pods, all the containers running on each node, and then send them to Splunk. So you configure Fluentd to write to Splunk, and then run Fluentd as a daemon set. So a Kubernetes daemon set basically has a pod running on every node. The guarantee given by Kubernetes is that it will run this pod on every node, and you configure it to collect the logs. So you can mount var lib containers or var log containers, and all the logs for all the containers will be captured by it, and it'll write it to Splunk. Yeah. And then Kafka and Zookeeper logs were written to Splunk by Fluentd. What about monitoring? So again, I need numbers. I need to see graphs. I need to see charts so that I can know that, hey, what are my requests? What's the memory? What's the CPU? So this is where Intuit again had a history of using a service called Wavefront, which was, I think, last year acquired by VMware. And Wavefront does a good job of keeping this time series database of all the metrics that you send it and then showing it in a nice, the charts and graphs, integrates with PagerDuty and so on. So we had to do two types of things. One is, what about cluster level metrics? From the underlying host, what is the memory being used? How much disk space do I have? What's the CPU utilization looking like? Those metrics which are at the cluster level. And the second is the application specific metrics. Kafka itself exports metrics about how many producers are there, how many consumers, which are the partitions which are offline, how many requests is it seeing per second. All of these kinds of metrics are already exported by Kafka. How do we get it from Kafka into this SaaS service called Wavefront so that I can see charts and graphs and have alerts? So We found that for cluster level metrics, most of Kubernetes clusters were running a component called Heapster. And this Heapster runs as one pod in the Kubernetes cluster. It knows how to talk to Wavefront. And then you configure Heapster to just collect all the nodes and then configure it to send data to Heapster. So it was doing that job. And for application-specific metrics, so I'll show a quick demo of this in a minute, but for application-specific metrics, there was a little bit of a dichotomy. The Kafka and Zookeeper pods expose metrics in a format called JMX, which is what Java does. Java exports metrics using JMX format. And Wavefront does not understand JMX. So we had to figure out how we can take a JMX metrics and then send them in some other format that Wavefront understands. And this is where Kubernetes' notion of sidecars was really useful. So you take the main pod, which is running Kafka, and you have sidecar pods, which can read those metrics from the Kafka broker pods, convert them into a format that Wavefront understands, and then ship them to Wavefront so that it can make sense. So this is where, again, the extensibility of Kubernetes and extensibility offered by containers really helped. So instead of just one broker, we actually run three containers in one pod, one running the broker and the other is running Telegraph for doing this translation and sending them to Wavefront. So this, So this is what I have. So this is where one example of Splunk. So this is the logs that we are seeing that are going to Splunk. The log message itself goes there, which is what this message is about. And then Splunk, or rather Fluentd, gave us this really cool thing called a Kubernetes plugin, where it would take the actual log message and then augment it with all the metadata about where it's coming from. So what is the pod that it came from? What is the pod here is Kafka-4. What's the namespace it's running? It's called Kafka NS. What is the Docker image it's running? What stateful set is it coming from? All of these kinds of things, this metadata along with the actual message now goes to Splunk, so it makes querying that much easier. So plus one for Splunk and Fluentd together. And this is what Wavefront gives us in terms of basic monitoring of the Kubernetes infrastructure. So this is the dashboard offered by Wavefront for any Kubernetes cluster. This one that I have right now, it has 24 nodes, 3 namespaces, 115 pods, and then all the kind of, you know, the standard stuff about CPU utilization by every node, memory utilization by every node, bytes transferred, yeah, networking traffic. What about file system usage metrics? How much file system, or am I running out of disk space? Those kinds of metrics are available here. And then last one, this one is the actual dashboard for Kafka-specific metrics. So this is where the sidecar that I was talking about came into picture. So Kafka brokers are sending some metrics, so there are zero under-replicated partitions, which is a good thing. If something goes wrong, this number shoots up. We have an alert for this. I hope it doesn't fire now because I'm on call. But these are application-specific metrics that go there about the consumer fetch. So there's not much happening on this cluster right now, which is why you see 500 milliseconds as the time required for it. So a consumer goes to Kafka and says, hey, give me any message that you might have. And broker just keeps that request on hold for 500 milliseconds and then returns saying, hey, you don't have anything, which is why you see it around 500 milliseconds. And other things, leader election. So if something goes wrong and leader goes down, what is the frequency at which leader elections happen? So on and so forth. A bunch of these metrics actually go there. And we are able to see this on Wavefront, which is a separate service. So even if I have lost access to the cluster itself, this service still is available for anyone to look at and debug. All right. So we had this cluster running. We had logging, monitoring. Awesome. You know, people were happy about this. But we always found that there were some last mile problems. Like, you know, people were like, oh, whenever I have to create a new topic, I have to go through this obscure method of, like, you know, SSHing into a pod and then running some obscure script, and I make a mistake at times. What can you do about it? So for that, we used a utility called Yahoo Kafka Manager. I know in this conference, in this room, previous just before lunch, there was a talk which said Docker is about running crap at you know, in containers or something like that. This is not that. This is the positive side of it, which is you get extensibility with containers. So Yahoo Kafka Manager is an open source project which gave us a good web-based front end for Kafka, and we were able to run this and give access to our users using a web-based front-end rather than having to do shell scripts. And same is the case with Zookeeper. Like, the Zookeeper command line tool is really, really something that needs work. I mean, it's complicated, it's complex. You have to run a complex, big, giant command. The Zookeeper web UI gave us a good front-end for doing this. And lastly, Argo. So Argo is actually a project for running workflows on Kubernetes. I'm actually part of the team that built Argo. And with Argo, what you get is a big, a nice a YAML file in which you can specify what steps you want to run. So this is something that we gave to any engineering team who wanted to onboard onto the Kafka service. So we said, you want to run Kafka, you create a topic, and here is a workflow. You run this, run one command, it'll actually run something within the cluster. It'll test basic things like creating a topic, writing some command, writing some messages, reading some messages. Is everything fine? Kind of giving them a tool for sanity testing their environments. So this was good. We had everything running. What about performance? So we were at about 35 milliseconds of end-to-end latency earlier. Where were we now? After adding SSL, after adding compression, after adding 9 brokers instead of 5, with all of that and other things remaining the same, as in replication factor of 3, in-sync replicas equal to 2, this is what we got. Same end-to-end latency. And I know I have two different lines here. The red one, which is now a little more like flatter than what it used to be earlier, which is good. The red one is actually the latency without any background sets. So imagine nothing else happening on the cluster. You had a producer, you have a consumer, and the only thing they're doing is that the producer is producing a message and consumer is consuming it. So the same kind of test that we did earlier for that, after giving it more resources and tuning other parameters, we were able to get a flatter line of about 17 milliseconds. So this is great. And then with background sets, so in the realistic scenario, we expected a lot more work to be happening on the cluster. And then if there is other stuff happening on the cluster, what performance should I expect out of this cluster? So that's what the blue line was. And the definition, so I'll share the slides later. The definition of what stress actually meant is actually there, about like, you know, few other producers producing random messages of about 4,500 or 4.5 kilobytes or something like that. And once the stress is running and you have one producer and one consumer, what is it that we are seeing there? That's the blue line there. So again, it was a little up and down depending on what else is happening on the system. But we were still, again, at an average of about 35 to 40 milliseconds. So we were well clear of our target of 100 milliseconds for running this. So this is good. If you want to run Kafka on Kubernetes, just watch out for these quick... I'll go through this very quickly before we can take maybe one question. So watch out for the fact that JMX metrics are not something that's supported by, even Prometheus, I don't think, supports JMX metrics. So you'll have to figure out how to convert them from one to the other. NAT gateways on AWS, as I mentioned, don't support TCP fragment or IP fragmentation. So they kind of drop this packet, check out for that. TCP MTUs, make sure TCP MTUs have to be set everywhere accordingly. We found that the actual broker pod that we were running did not have jumbo frames. So it was using a TCP MTU size of 1500. And the client was using a jumbo frames of 9,000 or whatever, 8192 or something, by those many bytes. So we had to actually make that change away in the broker itself. So make sure TCP MTU sizes are set accordingly. And then log message rate can be very high. So at some point for debugging, we set the rate to we set the log level to debug, and it overwhelmed Splunk. Like Splunk was like, you know, flaky because of that. So make sure that log messages are kind of, you know, appropriately configured. I wish I could give you like a nice conclusion which was like inspiring, that made you go away and just run Kafka on Kubernetes. But I have a very short message for you. If you are planning to run Kafka on Kubernetes, just do it. It's possible. It's fun. It made the lives of so many of our teams really, really easy, and they love it so far. There are still some things that we need to do, but so far our experience has been phenomenal. Thank you. And if you have questions, I'll be happy to.
Okay, we have time for one or two quick questions. Yes.
Yes, go ahead.
Does your system auto-scale in any way?
So the one that we have deployed does not. It is possible to auto-scale stateful sets in Kubernetes, and there are well-defined mechanisms for doing that. But the one that we deployed does not auto-scale. As of now, we don't have the need for auto-scaling. The requirements that we gathered for running the 9 brokers and all of that stuff does not require to auto-scale right now. But it is possible to auto-scale in Kubernetes, and you can define the conditions at which you can auto-scale and how and what action to take when you auto-scale. So you want to auto-scale up by 1 or 2 or how many, and then based on what criteria, CPU, memory, whatever. I'll also be available here for any other questions that you might have offline. after this talk. Go ahead.
Sorry, what version of Kafka?
We were using Kafka 1.0.1. I know Kafka 2.0 has been released. We haven't yet upgraded to that.
Okay, thank you very much.
Awesome, thank you.